Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of our show, we will return to a topic that we have discussed certainly many times over the years. We'll be talking about Afghanistan, and from time to time we do like to return to that country and talk about how things are going. And our guest for the show today, someone who has actually been a guest here on Focus 580 a number of times, although not in some time, we'll talk this morning with Marvin Weinbaum. He is currently a scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. He was for a number of years here professor at University of Illinois. He serves as director of the program in South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. He also is former Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence Research at the U.S. Department of State, has been senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, held Fulbright research fellowships for Afghanistan and Egypt, has written widely on this region and is interested in and has followed developments in Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Turkey for some years. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, of course, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that they are brief in their comments, and we ask that just so that we can keep things moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But certainly, questions from people listening are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois and Indiana. In fact, if you're listening on the internet and you're in the United States, you may also use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Weinbaum, hello.
Good morning, David.
I appreciate you giving us some of your time. It's good to talk with you again.
Surely. The pleasure.
To begin, I think, you know, the criticism is always made of those of us in the media that we always start with the negatives. So I'll stand that on its head just one time here to start out. And if we ask the question, in the now roughly 5 years since the Taliban were driven from power, we have seen a lot of changes in Afghanistan. We have a president, we have a newly elected government. If we ask the question, what can you point to as positive developments in the past 5 years, what would be on your list?
Well, David, I think you've really put your hand on the main improvements, and that is the bringing about of a government by the Afghans, a government that we would consider at least has the makings of a democratic system. There's an elected president. They have a parliament that was elected a year later. They have a constitution which most of us would consider to be a liberal constitution, and particularly a good one for the area of the world we're talking about. There have been many other improvements, certainly the number of children at school, which had dwindled to a pathetic few under the Taliban and during the civil war which preceded that. There are many who are going to school. There is reconstruction. I think all of this has to be seen, though, as being very uneven. There are parts of the country which clearly are benefiting from, have a post-Taliban dividend, and other parts which clearly have not gained very much. And that's mainly part of the problem, that large parts of the southern part of the country, people don't see what the benefits are in this post-Taliban period.
Well, given that, as you say, that there is a government, an elected government, a president, a parliament, the constitution, one of the downsides, I think one would have to say, is that that government, the control of that government is tenuous at best and only exercises full influence on a small part of the country. Why is it that that is the case and that the government doesn't have a greater control?
Well, I think we have to put it in historical context, too. Afghan governments ruling from Kabul never really were governments that had a great deal of penetration into the country. They appointed governors, and people cooperated with the center. But you had nothing to compare, for example, certainly with Saddam in Iraq, where every shot was called from the capital. This is a very decentralized country. It communications being what they are, the history of the people, different ethnic groups, and so on. It's never been a tightly governed state. So you have to start with that. But as you go on from there, it's true that this government could not exist without the international community's support, its economic support, certainly, but also its military muscle, which enables it to be as, to the extent that it is secure. Secure. He does as he does appoint governors. He does have influence as well, because many of the elements here, the warlords, the commanders, do cooperate with him. He may not be able to order them around the way a really powerful president might do, but at least for the time being, most of them are cooperative.
Mm-hmm. I think this is one of those places in the world where the United States would like to see the formation of a modern, viable, democratic state in according to that model that we would like to see. At the same time, you have to wonder whether it would be possible for, in a place like Afghanistan, to cultivate a kind of transcendent nationalism that would overcome the various other kinds of allegiances and identities that people would have. And I wonder whether in a place like Afghanistan, and if something like that is actually possible.
Well, you know, on one level it is. In Afghanistan, you don't need nation building as you do in Iraq, where people don't consider themselves to be Iraqis first, but would view themselves as Shia or Sunni or Kurds. In one sense, the Afghans are one people. All of the various ethnic groups in Afghanistan, and the Sunni-Shia split is not a terribly important one. It's more of an ethnic, and in that context, they do view themselves as Afghan. There's been no secessionist movement. There's no part of the population that wants to go elsewhere to join some other country, some neighbor, or to have complete autonomy from the center. So in that sense, you don't need nation building. You need state building. And that's really the hurdle that I think we're facing. And it's there because they've been fighting a war, in effect, since 1978. So the institutions that we normally would associate with a viable state are just, at best, just a shadow of what they should be as functioning entities.
Mm. Yeah, I suppose that's something that people should be reminded of, just how much disruption there has been in the country for such a long time now, going back to the Soviet invasion and then the battle to drive out the Soviets. And then that was followed by then a period of fighting among the forces that had driven out the Soviets. And then we had the Taliban, and then we had the war on the Taliban. So things have not been stable in this country. Life has not been normal in Afghanistan for a very long time.
David, going back to your point, though, about democracy, we perhaps have overstressed the need to build a democratic system there. We didn't go in with that initially as our objective. Our objective was to clean out al-Qaeda and their benefactors, the Taliban. We found ourselves, though, after a short time, that we couldn't walk away as we did after the Soviets left in 1989, and that we were going to have to stay around. And we had two tracks to take. One was a track which really was dedicated to the anti-terrorism mission that we had in this global war on terrorism. And the other track became, how are we going to rebuild this state? There are some who argue that in doing that rebuilding, we put too much emphasis on the institutions, because we wanted to show that this could be a democracy. And we, you know, in light of Iraq particularly, we're anxious to show that we bring democracy. But in doing that, we didn't do, I think it's clear now, we did not do nearly enough to make people feel secure, to give them as well the economic well-being that would give them a sense of a faith in the central government and in the national community in its role there.
Mm-hmm. As you say, the United States was intensely interested in Afghanistan during the time that the Russians were there. This was a battlefield of the Cold War. And when the Russians left, then the United States went on to other interests. Afghanistan just wasn't as important as it was. Now, perhaps there's not a point in asking a question like this, but I will ask anyway. If indeed the United States had continued to be engaged with Afghanistan and had worked on trying to rebuild the country all those many years ago, do you think things would be different today?
Well, of course, it's real speculation on this, but one of the mistakes that we made is that we were faced with, as you say, our main objective was to get the Soviets out of Afghanistan. When that happened, we didn't think we had a dog in the fight at that point, and there was a fight going on. It continued after we left between the Afghan communists and the Mujahideen, who were based in Peshawar, Pakistan. Now, there were many who argued at that point that what we needed to do, and there were plans for it, was to create a coalition government to absorb what was a very large part of the population that had remained behind and that was associated with the communist government, which had been moderating to some extent. By signing off on the Soviets' departure without putting in place a coalition government, many people say now that was the really best hope we had of stabilizing the country, because then for another 2.5 years they were fighting until the communists failed. And the reason they failed is that the Soviet Union failed. And when that happened, then the Mujahideen came in and then fought among themselves for the next 4 years until the Taliban arrived in Kabul in 1996 and started to push them out. And by 2001, the Taliban controlled all but a very small portion of the country, in the northeast, one sector, and really that was about it. And had there never been a 9/11, the Taliban probably would still be there.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Marvin Weinbaum. He is a scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C., emeritus professor at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign, where he served as director of the program in South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. He's also a former Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence Research at the U.S. Department of State. Now, he's joining us this morning by telephone. We're talking about Afghanistan. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the big challenges that's faced now by the government and also by the United States and those countries that have troops there is the resurgence of the Taliban. How does one account for that?
Well, it's in a way predictable, but I can't say that we predicted it. What happened after 2001, they were routed in October and November of 2001, the leadership was able to get into Pakistan and establish themselves in Pakistan, but they were a very small number at that point. Most of those who had been associated with the Taliban were average Afghans, and they went back to their farms or did something else. But there remained a command structure which did find a fairly hospitable environment in Pakistan. The reason they have come back, and their intention always was, they always felt that God was on their side, it was just a matter of time, and so they were still in the game. They had no other game to play, really, but they've been able to come back not because the Afghans are yearning for their return. Most Afghans got very, very tired of them. They represented a brand of Islam which was far too rigid for most Afghans, who were very religious, consumed with their religion, but a much more relaxed version of it than the Taliban represented. And I was in Kabul during the time, a short time, while the Taliban was just after they had taken over Kabul, and it was a graveyard. There was a great deal of anxiety, but people did appreciate the fact that they brought security. But at the same time, there was a feeling that we're never going to recover from all this war with the Taliban there. All the time that the Taliban were in power in Kabul from 96 to 2001, they didn't build any roads. They didn't build any schools. They didn't do anything. So clearly there was no reconstruction while the Taliban were there. So there's not a great yearning for the Taliban's return. However, in the large Pashtun ethnic belt in the south, and the Taliban were all Pashtun, in that belt, these were people who were very suspicious of the central government, even though Karzai himself is a Pashtun. And when, over time, they felt that they have not gotten the benefit of this new regime and have lost faith that this is going to bring them the recovery they expected, and at the same time have been inflicted by the return of the warlords, these local commanders, rapacious militias that feed off the local population. And this is the way it was before the Taliban came. So there is this bitterness now that not only haven't they seen the material rewards of peace and the international community's presence, but that life has returned to the same degree of insecurity that it was before the Taliban came.
We have a caller here, and rather than ask more questions, and I definitely have more, I will give them a chance to do that here in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Good morning. I'd like to ask a question and then get off and let you respond on the air. Hearing what you say makes me think about something which I've read elsewhere, which argues that the issues in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and even Iraq are really often tribal issues over which there's, let's say, where there's an overlay of Islam, which Islamic issues which sometimes co-opt or bleed into the tribal issues. And the tribal issues having to do with tribal cohesiveness, identification, hierarchy, leadership, tribal norms and customs, and in and out. In other words, being tribal or not being tribal. And your last couple of sentences recently was very much pointed to that in terms of talking about the Pashtun feeling what they did or didn't get. So I wondered if you could talk about that both in terms of Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan, and then maybe link that up with the failure of the U.S. to really address that because it deals with more national and idealistic issues having to do with democracy and national identity and international relationships among nations. So I'll get off the air and see what you have to say about that.
Thank you very much for the question.
Well, it is clearly, as I was suggesting before, we should not anticipate that there's going to be a strong national government. But you do want to have not a strong central government. You do want a national government. You want a government which speaks for all of the Afghans. I do think that's possible if you have modest expectations. Now, as far as the tribal element here, it, technically speaking, anthropologically speaking, it's the Pashtuns, the rural Pashtuns, who are really tribal. They have their own tribal code. They really do stand apart in some ways. It's not technically accurate to refer to the other ethnic groups as tribal. I know it's done all the time, but they're not. They're not organized on a tribal basis. They do have clans. They do have certainly an ethnic loyalties and so on. I don't see these necessarily as obstacles to the creation of a national government. And I put that in strong contrast to Iraq, where you do have, as I suggested before, where you do have these elements which clearly have not agreed to the notion that there necessarily ought to be a single Iraq, and they're fighting over real valuable resources. In Afghanistan, there really is nothing to fight over. There is no oil. There are no resources that are easily accessible, that can make one area of the country necessarily more valuable than another area of the country. So the ethnic differences that exist there are essentially negotiable. So if you start with the position that they do want to be one people, I can't stress that too strongly. Some years ago, I was asked in the late 80s, I guess it was, by USIS at the time, our information agency, to go over and to talk to some of the Mujahideen leaders for some future federated state of Afghanistan. And that would seem to make a lot of sense. Talk about it in Iraq these days. And I went there, and I was really amazed, just the suggestion that they would somehow be divided up. And they didn't understand the nature of federalism, that could be a sharing of powers. They saw this as tantamount to creating ethnic states within Afghanistan. And I couldn't get anywhere with these people, and that continues to be the case. They somehow want to be one people. They believe that their differences can be resolved. It's a question of the distribution of resources, of jobs, of reconstruction money particularly. This is the sort of thing that can be negotiated among groups if there's not great shortage. The mistake we made was not to put enough emphasis on this from the very beginning, and to somehow say, well, wait, let's get the security situation right, and then we'll go out and we'll take care of the reconstruction, not realizing the close interconnection between reconstruction and security. You can't have one without having the other.
All right. Well, I hope that gets to the question of the call. Let's talk with someone else. This is a listener in Urbana, and it's line number 2. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah.
Great work. I'm really appreciative of your efforts. In dealing with the Islamic world, if you want to just sort of lump them all into one group, do you think the United States is making a mistake, with possibly the exception of going into Afghanistan, of not confronting the Arabs, the innumerable amounts of Islamic cultures, by playing off their supposed internal differences, the Shia, the Sunni, that sort of thing, because I think historically they've always been sort of at each other's throats, and instead of confronting them militarily, would you have any take on that?
Well, with regard to Afghanistan, mm-hmm. I think this required, and still does require, a military dimension.
Mm-hmm.
There are some really nasty people out there, and remember,
oh, yeah.
We talk about the Taliban. It'd be nice to say, well, we'll just negotiate with the Taliban and we'll resolve those differences. But the Taliban leadership, at least, is so closely connected now with al-Qaeda and with terrorist jihadi groups inside Pakistan that, and they just, in fact, yesterday said they don't want to negotiate with anybody. This is a bad group. It's bad for us, and it's bad for the Afghans. But there's no question in my mind that the military attack on Afghanistan to oust the Taliban was, in the light of 9/11, was necessary. This was where the high command of the al-Qaeda was located. They had safe haven there. The war on terrorism, had it been focused on Afghanistan, had we completed the job there, had we really flushed out the terrorist elements, and had we then secured the country with, as I'm saying, the kind of reconstruction that they were yearning for, and brought enough troops in, because we did it very much on the cheap. What we did was, rather than bringing in the troops, because we were already thinking of our Iraq
mm-hmm.
action, and because we were thinking of our Iraq action, we put so few troops in. We, in effect, bought the loyalty of warlords, of commanders, who never delivered for us, and who then simply took over their areas. But had we focused on Afghanistan, I think we would have been spared a great deal of the anguish that we're seeing now in the global spread of al-Qaeda's influence. So Afghanistan has got to be separated. This was not the war of choice that Iraq was. And I and most people who follow Afghanistan were wholeheartedly in favor of a military action. We didn't want it to just be that. And again, we wanted it to be a greater commitment than it turned out to be. At the same time, when I was in the State Department and in the bureau that dealt with both Afghanistan and Iraq, we all had a very different view.
Yeah, I agree. Actually, I really agree with you on that point. I think it's one of the great tactical errors to not really take them out thoroughly. And we're paying for it now, and you're right about that. And it's I feel like you're sort of the voice in the wilderness, or the few of you that say this over and over again. I'll just say this and then let you go. But the BBC has been covering their, you know, British troops there and the NATO troops there, and they seem to be. I mean, the last thing I heard, they were running 2,000 or 3,000 air sorties in Afghanistan, which implies that there's a lot of ground action, and there's also an ineffective ground action because if you haven't used a lot of air power to blow up, you know, just 20 guys, it's ineffective, and it's probably, I agree with you, it's one of the great political and tactical errors, and the Bush administration should be done about it. But I really appreciate all your work, and thanks a lot. It's really interesting.
Sure. Okay. Right. On the issue of the bombing campaign, it's not only not effective, it is counterproductive. And I think that the NATO forces, the Canadians and the British, who have been conducting most of the operations now in the southern provinces, have come to realize that given the casualties that are occurring here in the civilian population, that they're going to have to go at this in a much more surgical way than they have, perhaps with less air power. But that's going to require more troops on the ground. And at the moment, our NATO allies are not willing to put more troops in. Again, more troops by itself is not going to be the answer unless those troops also are able to bring in changes that people can feel. Their loyalties will not go to the central government. Their loyalties will be at best ambivalent, and at worst they'll be yearning for the return of the Taliban.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Marvin Weinbaum. He's currently a scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. Between 1999 and 2003, he was Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence Research in the U.S. Department of State. He's emeritus professor here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He served as director of the program in South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies and has for a long time now been following developments in Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, and Turkey. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'd like to have you talk a little bit more about Pakistan, and I think that for a long time Pakistan has been something of a problem for the United States, viewed as certainly as an important ally. It was important at the time that we were funneling assistance to the fighters who were trying to drive the Russians out of Afghanistan, and it is important now that we're in Iraq. At the same time, I think that people in the State Department, I'm sure, would say that they're really not completely happy with the government of Pakistan and its involvement in surrounding countries and its incomplete commitment to the goals of the United States, particularly in terms of fighting Al-Qaeda. What can one say about what the aims of the government of Pakistan, and perhaps further you'd have to talk about its intelligence service and its army, what are the interests of Pakistan? Maybe we just limit ourselves to Afghanistan. What are the interests of Pakistan in Afghanistan?
Well, David, I think we have to take a step back here, recognize that when the Taliban were in control, and in fact from the time that they originated in 1994, Taliban meaning students, and many of these were madrasa students, they became really an arm of Pakistan policy. Pakistan wanted a favorable, friendly government in Kabul. And what it had in the Mujahideen government, which it had been sponsoring, once they got into Kabul, they didn't want to listen to Pakistan anymore. They, in fact, the last of their presidents was very close to New Delhi. That's an anathema, of course, to the Pakistanis. So the Pakistanis supported the Taliban. The Taliban could not have succeeded to the extent that they did in practically overrunning the entire country without Pakistan's support, logistical support, funneling of financial resources, and also volunteers, as along with Arab volunteers who came in with the bin Laden Al-Qaeda. So Pakistan's position was, at the time of 9/11, that they were, in effect, our enemy. They were on the side of the people that now we were going to attack. So as we now know, they were read the Riot Act right after 9/11. I remember that very well here, where they came in that next morning. And I saw them, the Pakistani well, the head of their intelligence and their ambassador came in, and they were shaking because they knew what they were in for, and they got the word that it was Pakistan's position was going to have to change. Pakistan was going to have to now cooperate with us against them, and it meant a 180-degree turn. And later that morning, the secretary was on the phone to President Musharraf and gave him, you know, no uncertain terms that you're with us or against us. And that's been repeated very often. So Pakistan came at this with a sympathy for the Taliban. And those elements that have been sympathetic to the Taliban have never completely gone away. Now we're talking about the area along the border, the tribal areas, which are somewhat semi-autonomous for the history of the country, those areas share the Pashtun identity, and they are, in terms of the way in which they look at Islam, very much like the Taliban. The Taliban learned their brand of Islam in Pakistan, in the madrasas of Pakistan, supported mainly by Saudi money, private and as well as governmental money. So you start with a portion of Pakistan, and unfortunately the very portion which borders on Afghanistan, which does not view the Taliban as the enemy. Al-Qaeda, they're a little bit ambivalent about. There are foreigners, but they gave them hospitality as well. But as far as the Taliban are concerned, they've not been the enemy right along here. So when we talk about the enemy as being the Taliban and they ought to be doing more to keep the Taliban from infiltrating into Afghanistan, a great many Pakistanis, certainly along the border, but even elsewhere in the country, say, well, that's your war on terrorism. It's not necessarily ours. And then we go to what the government's policy is. And I think here that they are that they've got two policies. They've got one policy which recognizes the United States is there. They've got a relationship with the United States, Pakistan does, which brings benefits, military hardware. They get economic assistance from us. They have no desire to diss the United States here. And so official policy here and also their own interests. Afghanistan, which is falling apart, could blow back on Pakistan. The radical Islamic control that would take place in Afghanistan would have an impact inside Pakistan. That's not something Musharraf and his government wants. So on one level, to please us and as well as to protect their own interests, you want to see a government in Kabul that succeeds. At the same time, they have a jihadi policy. They have a policy of supporting groups that partly because they need, in large part because they need these groups as a kind of surrogate force in Afghanistan as well as in Kashmir. And these groups, some of whom they actually outlaw, but in effect look the other way, and they don't want these groups to disappear because they're not sure that Afghanistan is going to be a stable country. They believe that we'll leave after a while. that perhaps the country will collapse. And they want to have cards to play inside Afghanistan. And their main card is the Taliban or elements which are associated with the Taliban, and they haven't been able to really cut their connection with it. Certainly there's real suspicion here in the intelligence services that they have maintained many of those connections. What we do know is they have never arrested a single leading Taliban figure, and we know that they are in Pakistan. They put 80,000 troops on the border, so-called, but 80,000 troops who had no capacity for anti-insurgency operations, who were a humiliation for the Pakistan military. And recently, you've heard about the signing of an agreement with the tribes there, because they recognize it's a failed policy. Militarization didn't work, and they've been trying something else.
Hmm. We have now about 10 minutes, maybe a little bit more, 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, very quickly, let me introduce our guest, Marvin Weinbaum. He is scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C., former professor here at the University of Illinois, where he served as director of the program in South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. He was an analyst with the Department of State. He was former Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at Bureau of Intelligence Research, and has been following developments in Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Turkey for quite a while now. Questions welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And let's talk next with someone in Champaign in line one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I just want to ask you, is it possible that Bin Laden and Omar, the former Taliban leader, can stay separate for 5 years, don't talk to each other, when I heard they were so close before? What do you think might be the reason for that?
Well, that's interesting. We have finally heard from Mullah Omar. Now, he was the spiritual as well as the political and military leader of the Taliban. And throughout this period, he's been supposedly in Quetta, which is provincial capital of Balochistan, and most of the Taliban elements are probably in Balochistan, not actually along the tribal area. We finally have heard from him, and in this latest statement that he's made, he said that I haven't had any connection with Bin Laden in all these years, and that's possibly true. There's no reason to believe that there is an open connection, but of course they have a great deal in common. And he, in the same statement, praised Bin Laden, wished him good health, which is a question mark at this point, but. That should come as no surprise. But I think if we go back, as the caller has suggested, if we go back to before 9/11, there was a very close relationship between the two men. And even though Mullah Omar was given the option of saving his government, we were not interested in regime change. All we wanted was Bin Laden and his entourage. And we gave, through the Pakistanis, we gave the option of saving the Taliban regime if they would render up Bin Laden. He refused to do it. He refused to do it because of his relationship with Bin Laden personally. He, you could say, it was part of the tribal sense that when you're asked for sanctuary, you give it. But nevertheless, he was willing to chance his own regime for that relationship. Today, what we do know is that the Taliban force, together with some Mujahideen groups that are dissident groups fighting against Karzai, together with Al-Qaeda, which is probably more terrorist cells now than any fighting force, that all of these elements are cooperating, even if they're not in direct communication.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to Charleston for another caller. This would be line two. Hello.
Thank you, Dave. I have only a question. If could your guest give me the name and his status today of the man who called Mr. Musharraf and said after 9/11, you'll cooperate with us or we'll bomb you to the Stone Age. Do you know the name of that man and what he is doing now?
Well, it was the deputy secretary, Armitage. Who supposedly, in the book, in Musharraf's his autobiography,
yes,
he doesn't say that it was said that bombing into the Stone Age. It wasn't said to him. Remember, I mentioned just a few moments ago that this intelligence chief came up to his office that morning, and there was a tough discussion whether Armitage used that language or not. That was certainly would have been close to what the spirit of his remarks would have been. Armitage today is a consultant, and he in fact has been he surfaced in the case involving Libby and Joe Wilson and Valerie Plame. That case, he surfaced there because it turns out he was one of the sources of information about her CIA connection. But he's made some very interesting statements about Iraq and Afghanistan, and now has shown really the extent to which both he and his very close associate, Secretary Powell, had misgivings about Iraq from the very beginning and were overruled.
Is he now, or was he then, a member of the CIA or the FBI when he made, you know, these statements were attributed to him?
No, he was the Deputy Secretary of State.
Deputy Secretary of State.
Yeah, and he had the portfolio which focused on Afghanistan.
Okay, well, thank you very much, sir.
All right, let's go to another caller. This is Champagne, line 3. Hello.
Thank you. Some 40 years ago, I had an opportunity to work with some 30 college teachers in Pakistan, and I was struck by the one Pashto in the group who stressed how important an epic adventure testing his manhood was in that area. None of the others did. And I wondered to what degree this cultural value of proving yourself in an adventure is important in the Taliban ventures in Afghanistan.
Well, that's that's what we talk about in the when we say that they have their own tribal culture. They are a very martial people. The British recognize this, and the British always said, "Don't trust the Waziris or the Momans." They recognize it, and that's why they left this area pretty much on its own, just with political agents coming in. They never tried to really govern it, because they are a very tough mountainous people. It's a very poor area. Smuggling is the only thing that really works in that area. And yes, they have a strong sense of. But the main theme though for them is honor. And that can take a martial side to it, but can also involve protection of women, many other elements where you would not lose face with your tribal neighbor or within your family. So honor really is the key to that Pashtunwali, which is their tribal code. And you see, everything else is somehow derivative of that value.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Would it have been possible, perhaps earlier on, at the point where the current Afghan government was being formed, would it have been possible to involve some elements of the Taliban leadership in the government?
Well, the government was formed almost immediately after 9/11. I should say after they were ousted. So it was formed in December of 01. The last remnants of the Taliban were eliminated from Afghanistan at that point in mid part of November 01. And there was immediately a conference in Bonn. And there are some now who said that what we should have done was Brahimi, who was the UN representative, has said this repeatedly over the years. We should have tried to bring in some moderate Pashtun Taliban elements. Now, it's a big question about whether then or now they're really there. Yes, there have been some Taliban people who have defected over the years, but those are people that we knew in the State Department that were already people we could talk to. It would have been a very good formula if we were able at that meeting in Bonn, where all of the various elements of the Afghan society outside of the Taliban, when they got together and they agreed that Hamid Karzai would be their president, if we could have brought in some of those elements. But I'm not convinced that we would have succeeded. Certainly we would not have succeeded with Mullah Omar or the people around them. That was just not in the cards.
You talked about the fact that we, at the beginning of the show, when I said, can you talk about positives, that there has indeed been some rebuilding effort, some reconstruction effort. At the same time, you have to acknowledge that, as you did, that the country has essentially been torn by war virtually since the late 1970s. And so the amount of destruction has been really, really significant. So when we talk about reconstruction, this is a significant, very big project. And if you ask the question, why is it that the reconstruction hasn't been more successful, I suppose one answer that some people will give is that the United States and the countries of Europe, those who promised to be involved in this and help pay for it, haven't been forthcoming, that they haven't done what they said they were going to do. Is that a fair criticism?
Well,
and it's partly, is it just a matter of money?
In a sense, they have made commitments. Some 46 countries have, at one point or another, made financial commitments. Not all of it has been delivered. Not all of it can be spent. Actually, the just in terms of financial commitments, I think that there obviously is need for more, but commitment is there. The problem has been that throughout much of the country, there has not been the secure situation and the resolve, really, to make the investment and not really to leave it to some future time, because as I suggested at the very beginning, what we did in effect was we put it off, and in the process we let that confidence in us and the central government slip away. Now, if you go to Kabul today, I spent a good portion of last fall in Kabul, and you wouldn't know that this was a struggling country in that sense. It's not Beirut in its best days, but it's bustling. Traffic jams are enormous. There are new buildings coming up and so on. But that bears very little relationship to what's going on in the rest of the country. Now, why has it happened in Kabul? Because there's been relatively strong security. That's where the international force sat, until we gave approval that they could go out into the rest of the country, a mistake, we delayed doing that, we were able to secure Kabul, and because of the large foreign presence, they have put money into Kabul. So there they got the investment, they got the security, and we've got the reconstruction. But it's hard to find any other part of the country except perhaps the western city of Herat where there has been anything like that kind of success.
When I take a look at some of the articles that have been written about Afghanistan just in popular press here in the United States going back the last few months, in back December and November and so forth, back into the fall, you get the sense that some people think that we may be at a very significant turning point here with and one significant problem here being the resurgence of the Taliban, and that the tone of a lot of this reporting seems to be that here we're at a point where things could go badly and we could end up having to make a more significant military commitment than we have now, and that it's a kind of a in fact, one story I have here in front of me, this was, I think, Los Angeles Times, early December. The headline on the story is, Afghanistan War Nears Tipping Point. Do you think that that's true?
Well, I think that we are at a crucial time, and this will be very clear in the spring when there is a renewed Taliban offensive. In that, this past year they had a lot of momentum, and the way we've handled the poppy issue has, in a way, strengthened them, because they've become the defenders of those who are growing poppy, and that's a large part of the southern part of the country. So we are at a tipping point, but I don't think that what we're looking at here is winning and losing. The international community, I believe, has got to be there for the long term. What has happened in that we have not done what we had to do is we've made the task of creating not a Switzerland here, just a rather normal, low-income country. That's all our expectation should be. It's stabilizing that. It's become more difficult. We have given the opportunity of the Taliban to make the kind of inroads, which now means that reversing this is going to take more effort, more resources, and conceivably more troops, but not just a military response. And I'm really worried now that we're moving toward in the way of a elimination of the poppy, eradication of the poppy, may alienate large parts of the population, particularly in the very Pashtun areas where we've got such problematic control.
There, we're going to have to finish because we're here at the end of the time. Our guest, Marvin Weinbaum, is scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute in Washington from 1999 until 2003. He served as Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence Research at the U.S. Department of State. He is emeritus professor at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign, where he served as director of the program in South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. And I want to thank you very much for giving some of your time. It's good to talk with you again.
Good talking to you, David.